knows what crime. Ooh, yeah. Ooh. Bobble by the month.
It's incredible.
Bobble by the month.
So mighty.
Bobble by the month.
Fantastic.
Bobble by the month.
Uncanny.
Bobble by the month.
There's one way to find out. I'm going to go over to that wall and find me a few heads to knock together.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Marvel by the Month. My name's Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
Rob, we're like 2 weeks away from the Books and Pictures show.
Yeah, we are, and I still feel terrified.
Yeah, it's our very first live show. It's going to be Saturday, February 29th, 6 p.m. at Books with Pictures here in Portland, Oregon. I haven't even read the issues yet.
Oh, I have not either.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, I just barely read these.
trying not to think too hard about that yet, although I am confident it's going to somehow turn out to be a great show.
Sure.
Yeah.
We will fail up.
Yeah. That's what we've done for 40-something years. So why stop now? And hopefully we will have our good luck charm in the audience as we have him in the studio tonight. Mr. Noah Campbell.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Four-time guest, Noah Campbell.
This is incredible.
You're going to get the smoking jacket.
Yeah.
Members
only.
You're so close. Well, thank you for joining us. We have, I think, a really crazy month of comics. I feel like the last month or two maybe wasn't a lot of major stuff. It was like one or two big high points, but yeah. This month is just absolutely insane. We've got a ton of new characters and new teams introduced. We've got new costumes for a few characters. We get Captain America's origin story.
And the Beatles
show up, yeah. Which is, it's all very exciting. I want to jump into those. First let's set the stage for what was going on in the world, when these issues came out. All these comics were cover dated March 1965. That means they were available for sale in January 65. So let's take a look at what was going on in January 1965, thanks to our friends at Wikipedia.com.
Please donate to Wikipedia.com. .org?
Good one. Nice plug.
Cool. I'm the best. I do advertising.
Do you think this is a good time to start mentioning that we're willing to promote your whatever for money on our podcast?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
And I mean, poorly, of course, you could guess. We'll maybe even say your product name right.
We'll fumble all over it, and our rates are unreasonable.
Okay, history. January 10th, 1965, 21 African-American players from the American Football League said that they would not play in the league's All-Star game in New Orleans, scheduled for January 16th. The night before, players had been refused admittance to the same French Quarter nightclubs that their white teammates had gone into, were unable to get taxi cabs to stop for them, and had insults shouted at them. The 21 men met at the Roosevelt Hotel where the East team was staying, and a majority voted not to play, according to Buffalo's Ernie Warlick, who served as the group's spokesman. The game would be rescheduled the next day to Houston.
Yeah, New Orleans... taking a little time to kind of get up to speed on that whole Civil Rights Act thing.
Yeah. I'm sure it's totally easy to get a cab now.
Oh, yeah. I thought this was pretty awesome. So we talk a lot about radiation on the podcast and the comic booky effects of it. So here's something that could have wound up creating a bunch of superheroes. We'll never know. But the NERVA program, which stands for Nuclear Engine for Rocket Vehicle Application.
Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. They conducted a test near Los Alamos, New Mexico, where the Hulk was born, to determine the consequences of, quote, the most devastating accident possible, end quote, for a nuclear reactor. With measuring instruments, including high-speed cameras to gather data, the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission used a nuclear rocket engine and applied an electrical power surge to make its reactor overheat in order to simulate a runaway reactor. The temperature rose to more than 4,000 degrees Celsius. That's over 7,200 degrees for you Fahrenheit folks, before the reactor burst, sending fuel hurtling skyward and glowing every color of the rainbow. Ooh. Pieces of radioactive fuel as large as 148 pounds were thrown upward, including a 98-pound portion that landed 400 yards away, and a radioactive cloud blew over Los Angeles and out to sea.
Oh, wow.
Which explains some things about Los Angeles.
that should have created at least a Godzilla.
Yeah, and it may have, because it did blow out to sea.
You're not supposed to do that.
No.
Yeah, it's not. It's frowned upon. On the 13th of January, President Johnson announced plans for a reform on U.S. immigration law, denouncing the quotas for different nationalities as, quote, incompatible with our basic American tradition, end quote, and proposed what would become the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. He said, "We have no right to disparage the ancestors of millions of our fellow Americans this way." Johnson told Congress the legislation would pass 326-69 in the House and 76-18 in the Senate and would be signed into law on October 3rd, 1965 in a ceremony staged at the Statue of Liberty.
Remember when we had presidents who looked out for immigrants?
Or anyone.
Or hashtag topical. Well, on January 15th, 1965, our birthday.
A little before our actual births.
Our pre-birthday.
Yep.
The first showing of The Sound of Music, my mom's favorite movie, starring Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer in 20th Century Fox's film adaptation of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, was made in a sneak preview at the Mann Theater in Minneapolis, Minnesota, with director Robert Wise in attendance. Preview cards from the audience showed 223 excellent votes, 3 good votes, and none for any lower category.
Wow, that's pretty good.
That's because Sound of Music is one of the best movies ever made.
Yeah, if you're going to have Nazis in a musical, that's the one.
Yep, that's a pull quote for the DVD. If you're going to watch one movie with Nazis in it, make it Sound of Music. Ralph Mill, Marvel by the Month.
It's more uplifting than, you know, Schindler's List, I guess. So on the 15th,
on our birthday,
Adam Jones, guitarist for alternative metal band Tool, was born in Park Ridge, Illinois.
Yeah. Hmm. Did you know that?
No.
I did not.
I'm not a big Tool fan.
Yeah.
But you are a big Tool.
I am.
<Ba-da-psh>. So I knew we had Charo and obviously Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
and Regina King, who played Sister Knight on Watchmen.
Yep. Yep.
And who else did we just find? Oh, Mr. Worldwide Pitbull was born on our birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's quite
prestigious
a roster.
Prestigious company. Cool.
Well, let's see. The very next day, on the 16th of January, U.S. Marshals arrested 18 men in Philadelphia, Mississippi, including the sheriff and deputy sheriff of Neshoba County, in the case surrounding the 1964 murders of civil rights activists Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. So still following that story, which basically the story of it has been that the feds move in and make a bunch of arrests, and then local officials
let everybody go.
So still trying to actually get justice for, you know, people who were murdered just because they wanted to sign people up to vote.
On the 24th, Sir Winston Churchill, you might have heard of him, the former prime minister of the United Kingdom, who had guided Britain through World War II and later through the economic problems of the 1950s, died at the age of 90, 2 weeks after suffering a severe stroke. His final words reportedly were, "I'm so bored with it all." Sir John Colville, Churchill's private secretary, would recall that 12 years earlier in 1953, Churchill had said, "Today is the 24th of January. It's the day my father died. It's the day I shall die too." Lord Randolph Churchill had passed away on January 24th, 1895, exactly 70 years before his famous son.
He called his shot.
Well, that's like pointing to the bleachers. See, that, Sports Reference?
That's where I'm going to die. Okay, last item on the agenda for our historical context this month. On the 27th of January, we haven't talked about Vietnam for a little bit, so
this is a big one.
Oh boy, here's where it all goes. I mean, it was already going pretty south, but now here's where it goes fully south. U.S. National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy and Secretary of Defense Robert S. McNamara presented to President Johnson their report, R.E. Basic Policy in Vietnam. In what would become known as the Fork in the Road Memorandum, Bundy and McNamara recommended him to escalate the Vietnam War rather than to pursue a peaceful resolution. "What we want to say to you," Bundy wrote, "is that both of us are now pretty well convinced that our current policy can lead only to disastrous defeat. Bob and I are persuaded that there is no real hope of success in this area unless and until our own policy and priorities change. The two alternatives that they envisioned were presented as assertiveness or timidity. The first is to use our military power in the Far East and to force a change of communist policy, while the other was to deploy all our resources along a track of negotiation aimed at salvaging what little can be preserved. Of those choices, Bob and I tend to favor the first course, Bundy wrote, but we believe that both should be carefully studied and that alternative programs should be argued out before you. He closed by noting, McNamara and I have reached the point where our obligations to you simply do not permit us to administer our present directives in silence and let you think we see real hope in them. Johnson would choose the first alternative, and by the end of the year, more than 200,000 American troops would be in South Vietnam.
And that went well.
Went great.
Kicked butt. Right?
Yes. Don't look further forward in history than this.
Yeah.
Just don't, stop there.
Don't all read right? any books. Like any books.
Ever. Or watch any movies. Or...
It's good to know he won.
Just bask in that glow.
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to put Rob in the hot seat on Marvel by the Minute here on Marvel by the Month. Hey, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. So we read every comic that comes out every month. This month, like most other months, there are just too many of them to cover in depth. So we're going to take a look at three of them a little later in the podcast. But everything else is going to be weaponized against Rob's generalized anxiety disorder in this segment, which we call Marvel by the Minute. Noah, you know how this works. Mm-hmm. So Rob gets 60 seconds to try and tell us what happened in these issues, which he'll almost certainly fail to do.
Oh, yeah.
And when he's done, somehow we actually know less about them than when he started talking. Jump in and help him out if you feel like it, or just watch him flounder. It's good fun either way.
Oh.
How you feeling, Rob?
Just as terrible as usual.
Awesome. Okay, well, our first issue that we're going to talk about is Tales to Astonish number 65. We got two stories in here. The first story is called The New Giant Man. But don't get your hopes up. It's still the same old Giant Man.
Oh, it's almost worse.
Yeah. It's written by Stan Lee. The art is by Bob Powell, with Don Heck doing the inks. And this issue basically features Giant Man and Wasp versus Giant Man's general incompetence. But he does get a new costume out of it. We also have the backup story is the Hulk story, which is called On the Rampage Against the Reds. Not the Cincinnati Reds, but communists. It's written by Stan Lee, art by Steve Ditko with Dick Ayers. It's Hulk versus the leader and some commies.
And the spongy robot things, the right. Humanoids.
They got a good agent. They've been in a lot of issues lately. Okay, so I've got 60 seconds on this here clock. You think you're up for this?
Whatever.
Go for it.
Okay, so Giant Man, it is truly his incompetence. He's trying out some new... I don't even know why he's doing this. He's trying out some new shrinking thing and manages to make his cat giant, make a spider giant, a tarantula-like spider. The main point is Janet Van Dyne explores her fashion sense and makes him a better costume. So that's a part of the development of her character as a designer. Next.
There you go.
We'll go into that in a second.
That was a gloss over.
Hulk fights a bunch of those spongy humanoids again. Tries to get away, turns into Puny Banner underwater, almost drowns. He gets taken in by some commies. Then he gets put in a little cell. He breaks out of the same cell they put Banner in as the Hulk. Nobody figures it out. He does a thunderclap, gets away.
That was, I mean, not good, but great.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. For me, that is a solid D+. There's
I
so much
the,
in there.
The Giant Man story.
Yep.
Yeah.
What a jackass.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's not any better. He's an idiot.
So he's ignoring, his girl comes in, he completely ignores her.
Yep.
Until she finally gets his attention by flying around his head. Then he explains that he's developing a weapon that he's going to test on the cat. And she's like, oh, don't do that. And then she's like, your outfit looks like you look like a slob in this thing. And then she actually points to an old outfit, which looks like something like out of The Tick. It's a bad outfit. And then she just is worried that he's going to look stupid. And so she's going to redo his outfit. And then he immediately tests the thing on the cat as soon as she leaves the room.
And spills something.
Nearly kills him. The cat gets huge and starts stalking him. And then he gets distracted and, he spills a giant serum on a tarantula. Which, have you ever seen a tarantula in your house? Where the hell does this guy live?
Also, when the cat changes back to normal size, his solution is to become a giant to grab the cat with one hand. Just to terrify the cat more, I guess.
Yeah.
Trust me, giants terrify cats.
Okay, let's jump into Sergeant Fury number 16.
Okay, I kind of remember this.
Yeah, you probably remember it better than I do. But the story is called A Fortress in the Desert Stands. It's written by Stan Lee. The art is by Dick Ayers, inked by Frank Ray. All I have in my notes is that the Howling Commandos are in North Africa.
That's pretty good, man.
So there you go.
I say let's do it.
All right, go for it.
Okay, so a deep cover agent breaks cover to tell the allies that there is a missile base in the middle of North Africa. So immediately the Howlers are sent there in seconds. They they get there and things go immediately wrong because it's the Howlers. And they have to, Reb gets almost blown up. They go to this abandoned Foreign Legion or French Foreign Legion post where these missiles are being held, and Dum Dum gets captured. They have to try to get, when they're trying to get him, Reb gets hurt. They end up relying on the help of some Bedouins in the middle of the, who they call Arabs and stuff, in the middle of the desert. They get in, they blow up everything, like exquisitely, Izzy's biggest explosion. And they stop this missile threat to the Allies. Bam!
That is the first time you finished one of these and had seconds left at the end.
Yeah, and it was somewhat coherent.
I know.
That wasn't exactly how you do it. Oh, man. As soon as I got home, I was just telling my wife what a bad job you did.
It's true.
In the defense of the story, there wasn't a mind swap that tricked a bunch of people.
Like me trying to explain. But Doom in Reed's body is fighting Reed, lying to Sue, who's invisible and only. Yeah, it's not one of those.
Yeah. It's just war.
It's just straightforward.
War is hell, but
they're
going to
go blow some stuff up.
Right. Yeah.
And they do.
Well,
the end.
Well, okay. Well, talking about one of those stories where a lot of crazy stuff happens.
Oh, no. Here we go.
Here we go. Amazing Spider-Man number 22. I very nearly wanted to make this a focus issue for this episode because it's just so absolutely bizarre. But the story is called Presenting with Six E's. The Clown and His Masters of Menace. The Clown and His Masters of Menace was like a working title for Motley Crue, I'm pretty sure, back in the day. It's written by Stan Lee. The art is by Steve Ditko. It's basically Spider-Man versus the Clown and his Masters of Menace, who were formerly known as Ringmaster's Circus of Crime.
Why don't you get the names of the people out of the way to save you an extra
second? Yeah, let's do it.
Cast of characters here, because this is worth mentioning.
Okay, so we have the Crafty Clown.
Yep.
He has no other name.
Mm-mm.
Just Clown.
Rides a unicycle.
Has a big hook. The Great Gambanos. two acrobat brothers. The man called Cannonball, who has like a bullet-headed riveted costume.
Yeah, he's a human cannonball.
Princess Python, who just has
snake lady.
Yeah, she's a snake lady. She's got like green stuff on. And the Ringmaster, who is pretty sad in our very first splash page.
Yeah, he looks pretty grumpy on the first page.
Yeah, well, there's a reason for that, which Rob is about to tell us all about. I have 60 seconds. Are you ready to do this?
Let's do it.
All right, go for it.
Okay, so this I already forgot the name of the damn it. The circus folk have been released from prison from their last caper. And they've gathered in some seedy apartment. Spider-Man is directly onto them and comes in to just warn them and plant a spider tracer on Ringmaster's hat because he knows they're going to get into crimes.
Right.
And they're all in costume already, too. It's just weird to see a bunch of circus folk in an apartment.
Yeah.
But then they immediately fire the Ringmaster and then go off to do crimes. So Ringmaster isn't involved. Spider-Man can't track their crimes. But he happens to be at an art exhibit that JJ is putting on, and it sucks. And he's with Betty, who talked him into going. That our exhibit is hit by the rest of the what is their name?
The Masters of Mayhem.
Masters of Mayhem. And they end up getting captured. There's a bunch of double crossing between the clown and the ringmaster.
Yep. Spider-Man fights a giant snake.
Spider-Man also hypnotizes the ringmaster with his own
hat.
With
his own hat.
Which I thought was a pretty smooth move.
He hangs it on his web and that seemed iffy, but it worked.
Also, knowing how to make it work, I thought hypnotism was still a main part of that. Like to know how to suggest.
It's just the hat. He has no talent whatsoever.
Spin a thing on a hat. It's like from a cereal box.
My big beef with this, it was pretty awesome, is they go to this art show and they're looking at the art, and there's like a little joke from the artist in there that he's saying, boy, I wish I could draw feet like that. But the art that he's looking at is
a giant foot.
It's a painting, apparently, with a sock on it, but it's a worn out sock and the big toe sticking out of a hole in the front. So that's the art. That's modern art, I assume.
Right.
I don't remember seeing any of that.
Well, like the whole running gag is that all modern art is garbage.
Right.
Like, this is really like Peter Parker is supposed to be a teenager, but he's talking like a curmudgeonly old man.
And he's like, I don't think anyone likes this art. However, later when they're stealing it, they're describing it as priceless art. And I have trouble believing that you couldn't find a price for that.
Yeah, our hero is leading us to believe this is garbage.
I believe Spider-Man in this one.
Yeah.
The other thing too is he runs off during this. He's trying to juggle chicks in the beginning.
Yes.
And he's worried that Betty is going to see Liz and get all jealous.
Right.
And then he'd be finished in her league if she sees that.
Right.
He's jealous
and
whatnot. But then all hell breaks loose and he's like, shit, I have to turn into Spider-Man like right away. So he takes her home? Is that what happens between that panel and the next panel?
All this goes down.
Oh, here, I missed
J. Jonah gets hit in the head. He gets taken away to the hospital.
He does take her home.
He walks Betty home. Minute her door is closed, he turns into Peter Parker.
Exactly 10 seconds after her door closes. Yeah, he turns into Spider-Man.
He patiently spends that intervening 50 minutes or whatever just letting the criminals wander off.
Yeah.
What does he care if a bunch of dumb art gets stolen?
Part of me thinks that maybe he won't even fight this girl, the
Princess Python.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
She wraps her arms around his arms, and I thought, oh, maybe she's got Python powers? Like,
no,
can squeeze.
She just has a giant snake.
That's it. She's just a sexy lady.
Yeah.
Bummer.
Anyway, kicks all their butts, and
and he emerges triumphant.
And he snaps a bunch of pictures of them doing a perp walk and brings them back to that head boss of his.
Peter Parker's got like super snarky over the last.
Yeah, he totally
episodes.
Trashed. He's like, his boss is like, you're fired, dude. Because whatever he's in a bad mood.
He insulted his boss. He said, I knew you'd be okay, JJ. After all, you were only hit on the head.
Right. Yeah. And that's why he's acting like, I'm going to fire you. And he's like, not after you see these pictures. He knows he's got the leverage with those nice front page photos.
Yep.
Yeah. The Peter Parker, like, smarmy face, like, self-assured face is a weird thing, but it's like dialed in.
Yeah.
it's just him looking like, I'm such a badass now. Check this out.
Well, on that note, let's move on to X-Men number 10.
Mm.
The story is called The Coming of Kazar.
Convoluted and all to hell.
I didn't read it.
Did you know that Kazar was pronounced Kazar? I grew up pronouncing it Kazar.
Yeah, I knew it was Kazar. I didn't know. I think they say how to pronounce the Sabretooth's name too. But
Zabu?
Zabu.
Zabu. So this one was written by Stan Lee, the art's by Jack Kirby, ink by Chick Stone. So it's the X-Men in the first appearance of the Savage Land. It's also the first appearance of Kazar. One thing I'm just going to throw out there is I really love Kirby's artwork in this. I love his depiction of the Savage Land.
Yeah, that's my favorite. The rest is a convoluted mess.
I look forward to you trying to untangle in 60 seconds.
Just try to say the high points. And
okay. Well, no time like the present. Give it a shot.
Okay. So the X-Men, they hear about this expedition in the Antarctica that suddenly is attacked by a saber-toothed tiger and a and a weird guy with almost nothing, with a loincloth, basically Tarzan.
Right.
And so they hear about it on the news and they're like, that's probably a mutant. Nobody's going to be running around without clothes on up there. That's their theory. And so they head up, they find this hole and a tunnel into a world underneath the ice that is prehistoric. And this is where Kirby rocks it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All kinds of crazy prehistoric tiny horses with weird faces.
And it's like a prehistoric tropical jungle. Like it's very warm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that what the flat earthers believe?
Probably.
Yes, that is what we believe. Yes.
There's all kinds of crazy creatures. There's like
Rad.
Neanderthal riding.
Why didn't I read this one?
I don't know. You missed out. I ran out of time.
Yeah.
They're riding these like He-Man looking ostrich type beasts.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. It's a great story.
It's no T-Rex with a laser gun and a spacesuit, but
right.
Ah.
Listening to Noah read this in real time is fantastic audio.
Let's pause the show really quick.
Check out that panel. It's like
that's badass. This yeah. is a
yeah. You missed out.
I made a fool of myself.
I mean, I made a fool of myself. You just didn't read the comic.
Yeah, but yeah. So they journey to the Savage Land. They beat the bad guys. As they're leaving, Cyclops turns to Kazar and just tells him, it's like,
well, we'll be friends forever.
You'll yeah. always have friends in the X-Men. And Kazar is like, get out and never come back.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
I love it when, as we're reading these issues where like, something comes up that's like, here's a new major location in the Marvel universe. So like the Savage Land, the X-Men return to it time and time and time again. Like it just becomes like a major part of this mythology. Like, this, you know, secret land that time forgot. Moving on to Tales of Suspense, the number 63. We got two stories here. We got the Iron Man story and the Captain America story. The Iron Man story is called Somewhere Lurks the Phantom. It's written by Stan Lee. The art is by Don Heck with Dick Ayers. Iron Man versus the Phantom. I don't remember anything about this issue, so you are absolutely on your own here.
I read it recently, and I don't remember. I mean, today, and I don't remember anything.
Yeah,
I remember Captain America's story, but yeah.
The second story is the Captain America story. It's the origin of Captain America, written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby with Frank Ray. They say written by Stan Lee. Joe Simon should have gotten a co-writer credit on this because
shout out.
It's basically just an adaptation from Captain America comics number 1 from 1941, but yeah, it's the origin of Captain America. What do you got to say about it, you know? So
watch a movie, kid.
Yeah 60 seconds, you ready to talk Phantom and where Captain America came from?
Sure.
All right, give it a shot.
So I thought the Phantom was going to be maybe one of the other Phantoms we've seen already.
Oh, right. Yeah,
wasn't.
No.
Just some other guy in a fairly cool costume trying to sabotage, guess what? One of Tony Stark's plants, and many of them, actually.
Yep.
Planting cool bombs. The main thing that happens in that issue is Tony Stark makes some new transistor that's triple powered, so he might not have to wear his armor all the time.
Yeah.
Which gets him out of pretending that Tony Stark might be dead and being the boss.
Yeah.
He eventually catches this guy. He wasn't even working for the commies. He was just a disgruntled employee who, you know, didn't get enough attention. So he started blowing stuff up.
Yep.
That's kind of what he says. So Captain America, it is the story. Weirdly, though, round shield. So it is the story of the original Captain America. But I kept going, wait a minute, that shield is a circle. So he gets a super soldier serum. He becomes the hero that we all know and love.
Ta-da! Nice work.
I'm impressed.
Noah looked around like I had been swapped with somebody else for a second.
That's like a coherent description of something. I will say that is a pretty cool outfit.
Yeah.
Although, if I were, I could draw that in.
You're talking about the Phantom? Like,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sort of toga thing was in.
It's sort of badass.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got it's like a purple hood with a black mask with a blue band across the eyes.
Yeah,
his nose is out. There's something like very golden age, like the shadow about it.
Yeah.
That I like without the big weird hat of the shadow.
Right. Well, nice. Rob, you're almost out of the woods.
Oh, thank goodness.
The only issue we have left is probably the most impossible issue to describe in this entire month's worth of comics. It's Avengers number 14.
Oh no.
It's written by Stan Lee with Paul Lakin, who is Larry Ivy writing under a fake name, and Larry Lieber. So we got Stan doing the plotting and then two scripters. And then the art is by Jack Kirby doing layouts, Don Heck penciling, and Chick Stone inking it. So there are three writers and three artists on this thing.
Yeah, it shows. Everybody. It's dense with big budget.
Yeah, and it's just, this really struck me as they had 4 days to do a comic book, and they just threw everything they had at it. And it does not make any sense. It's got a lot of Lieber tropes in it.
Lieber, man. Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah.
Yep. So basically, the Avengers are fighting to save Wasp's life. As you remember, she was critically injured by surprise at the end of the last issue. It's absolutely nuts.
So Stanley wrote the plot on a napkin, and these guys wrote way too much words.
Something like that.
And somehow, even though Larry wasn't drawing, the aliens that do appear look like Lieber aliens.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, well,
let's just take a shot at this nonsense.
You got 60 seconds. We'll just try to get through this one. Okay, go for it.
Okay, so at last, we had the cliffhanger last time. Wasp's about to die. We start right in the action. The Avengers are running because Giant Man won't let anyone carry anyone like Thor, who can fly, or Iron Man, who can fly, carry the Wasp to get her to a hospital. He's just running down the road. They get to a hospital. They find out she's got something, the bullet lodged near her lung. They need to find a specific surgeon. Don Blake can't help them. I mean, lame Dr. Blake. He's not that good of a surgeon. He thinks that's Thor thinking, like, I'm not that good of a surgeon. So then they hear about a guy that they go to get him. This Dr. Svensson, who's this respiratory lung guy. But he turns out to be an alien who has a rubber mask on, and the real Dr. Svensson has been held under the ice, I think in Antarctica again, I'm not sure, by some aliens.
And let's also mention that
there's a 48-hour clock before she dies too.
Let's also mention that when Giant Man removes the alien's rubber mask to reveal that he's not Dr. Svensson, it kills the alien. Because he's using it to breathe. Mm-hmm. So Giant Man is at best involuntary manslaughterer.
Yeah. Yeah. He is not broken up about it.
No, not at the least.
Yeah. It looks like he's grieving, but he's just upset that it did, like, the guy's dead and he can't exploit the guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And then the aliens, though, is it a benevolent race of aliens and they're like hiding out because there's a warlike race of aliens?
Yeah, they've been being chased. That's the other more inscrutable part. They've been being chased by several warlike aliens and they've been hiding on Earth under the ice so they can't be detected.
Right.
And they don't want to, they're not really benevolent, but they don't want to take over the Earth.
Right.
So, you know, it's like a fine line.
And then the aliens, then there's like a 3 or 4 page section where the aliens just kind of sort their stuff out. Independent of the Avengers. So it's like, it stops being an Avengers comic for a few pages. it's such a bizarre book.
And it gets it's put into some weird place where the aliens, basically the Avengers threaten them and say, get off the planet before these guys come after you.
Right. Is this where we find out that she's going to survive?
Yeah, we do. Okay. Right at the very end.
Yeah.
There is some funny scenes at the beginning where the doctor's like, it's going to be about 30 minutes before I can tell you anything. So Earth's Mightiest Heroes go sit in the waiting room.
Yes.
And they just sit there idiots.
And Giant Man refuses to shrink down to less than 12 feet in the hospital.
He's in the waiting room.
Yeah.
He never shrinks down. He's just, man, that guy.
Yeah.
He really gets my goat.
He really does. Okay, man.
I survived.
Somehow you survived once again. Nice work. Let's go ahead, take another break. When we come back, we will start talking about Strange Tales and the appearance of a certain Fab Foursome that meets two of a Fantastic Foursome here on Marvel by the Month. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We're going to talk Strange Tales number 130. There's two stories in here. The first one we'll talk about in just a second, but we'll do a very quick recap of the second story, which is called The Defeat of Doctor Strange, written by Stan Lee with art by Steve Ditko. It's another Doctor Strange versus Baron Mordo story.
I know. You know what was weird is on the cover, It says the defeat of Doctor Strange, a tale so different, so unexpected that we just had to give it the feature cover spot this issue.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, this is going to be some new Baron Mordo story.
And it kind of is.
Yeah, there's a twist.
Yeah. So basically the twist is that Baron Mordo gets powered up by Dormammu, who, remember, he's been prohibited from invading Earth because Doctor Strange saved him. But he found a loophole and he's like, I can just give Baron Mordo all my power and have him take out Doctor Strange.
If these loopholes in these comic books, pretty shady.
They hold up under full legal scrutiny.
Yeah, I mean, right. This wouldn't make it through.
But
a court
I guess, like, who do you appeal this to?
It's true. It's trying to, I can think of
the living tribunal.
A similar case in real life.
But yeah, so Mordo, he's got Dormammu's power. He's got more than enough magical might to defeat Doctor Strange and the Ancient One. And so by the end of the issue, Doctor Strange, he's in hiding. He's in civilian clothes.
Yeah. And he had to fold up his cape and tuck it into the suit jacket.
That's right. So he can still levitate. But he is on the run.
He's not happy about it either.
He's not. He's not at all. So it ends in a cliffhanger. We will find out hopefully next month if Doctor Strange is able to prevail over Baron Mordo. He does.
they made a movie about him just recently.
but I wanted to save the majority of our time for this segment for the first story here. And Rob, would you like to go ahead and introduce what we'll be talking about?
This is The Human Torch and the Ever-Loving Thing, Meet the Beatles. So Meet the Beatles, written by Stan Lee, art by Bob Powell, who also did...
He did the Giant Man story.
Giant Man story. Okay, so Human Torch and the Thing meet the Beatles.
Can I just say how absolutely insane it was for Stan to call this unlicensed Beatles story Meet the Beatles?
I know. Yeah.
It's just real shameless. Yeah.
I was like, did Brian Epstein like call them? Like, speak of product placement.
Yeah.
Not that they needed it at this point. I think this is the 1 month the Beatles, I think they were touring again, but they weren't recording or releasing an album in January of 1965.
So
weirdly, the month that they weren't doing anything with a big release, they were in this comic book.
There you go. They're everywhere.
Yeah. Fantastic. Without even trying. Yeah.
Yeah. So you want to just go through this page at a time?
Yeah. We start off with the usual, the boys having a little fun, just messing with each other while Sue and Reed and Sue have recently become engaged. So they're heading off to a city hall conference because that's how they party. The boys are supposed to be putting together this machine. I don't know why Reed would leave them in charge of putting together a machine. Johnny offers to help him spot weld something from the air and shoots a flame down and burns his toe.
Yeah.
So they just get in a fight and trash the machine.
Yep.
They completely destroy they knock it over, break it in half.
They're like having giant cat monkeys in your house. They just mess everything up every time. And that's the whole story of both Johnny Storm in Strange Tales and Johnny Storm and Ben Grimm. They just, they mess up like every piece of cord. They almost set the world at war with their hijinks.
Yeah. But they're just, boys being boys.
Such idiots.
But Alicia and Dory Evans are out on the town. And what's going on with them?
Dory notices this poster. Guess what? The Beatles are in town. Then as she's mentioning it, the Beatles walk by them. And of course, Alicia doesn't see them, but
she knows they're the Beatles.
Describing it. And she hears their, what did she say? I heard four sets of footsteps in British accents.
Yeah.
So she guesses that it's the Beatles.
Yeah.
It has to be.
So they buy four tickets then.
Yeah. And also, there were tickets available. It's like the day of the show or something.
With the band walking by.
Yeah, like, oh, we're here for the show. And they're like, let's get tickets. Do you know what it's like to get tickets for a show? I mean, it might have been easier back then.
Right. Somehow the internet did not make it easier.
Well, I'm also guessing that Stan Lee at 40 whatever years old
has no idea how it works.
Absolutely no idea. Yeah. Yep.
And also, since we're talking about that, I would say that Bob Powell has no idea what they look like. I think he drew the Beatles based on what he heard someone describe the Beatles as. Tell me, which Beatle is that? The guy in the front.
The guy in the front is Ringo. That's
That's definitely the guy.
He's got the largest nose.
And there's Paul McCartney in the center there.
McCartney is next to Ringo.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the ear guy?
Yeah. Who's the ear guy?
I don't know. That it could be. It's the other two are George and John. And honestly, I couldn't tell you who is who.
And they don't. None of them look. So Ringo vaguely looks like just has a larger nose than the other guys, which is how every caricature.
Well, Ringo looks like the giant doof. So that's how you know it's.
That's true. He also has like buck teeth in this thing.
His like eyes are closed and his
He's not that dumb.
Heartthrobs, huh?
Yeah, they. I think he just looked at some people that were nearby and made like Vulcan ears on one and said, "They're the Beatles. They're in black suits.
There you go.
Their hair looks silly."
Yeah. So anyway, the girls tell the boys that they're going to go see the Beatles. Ben is not super excited about it until he sees that Alicia is excited about it. And then he's like, oh, yay. I was thinking we should do the same thing.
Yeah.
Because he's a supportive boyfriend. Because he looks like a pile of rubble. Like, he's got to play his cards very carefully.
No crap. I mean, if I were him, I would go to. Also, just really quick, they smashed up the Fantastikar too while they
knocked
the big piece of machinery that they were supposed to be fixing onto their fancy car. And then they're like, the whole time they're fighting, they're worried about when
Reed comes home.
Yeah, he's going to bust him.
When dad gets home, this
is like the Skipper and Gilligan. It's like everything with their bumbling is comic. It's like the Honeymooners or something.
Totally.
So then they're late to go to the Beatles show?
They're stuck in traffic.
Basically trashing the city trying to get to the show on time.
They're stuck in traffic, so Johnny like fires a
huge fireball in the sky.
Ben lifts a car out of the way and gets their cab going down an alley. Then he lifts up the cab so everybody can climb in on a fire escape.
On the second floor.
Yeah, puts them right with the Beatles again.
Yeah, yeah. So they see the Beatles again. This is the second time they have run into the Beatles by chance. Have you noticed that so far the Beatles have not said a word?
For legal reasons.
That's what I'm wondering.
Well, it's not like you'd be able to know which one was talking.
That's true. Then Ben loses his damn mind when he sees the Beatles, which is funny because he was like, I'd rather go bowling. But then once he sees them, he's like, it's them, my ever-loving idols. Be still my pattering heart.
Oh, I thought he was just doing that to impress his girlfriend seem like he was into him.
Possibly.
Because it seems sarcastic. Because if I said that, you'd be like, what a prick.
Yeah, but everything you say is sarcastic. So it's
That one's...
That's true.
Be still my pattering heart? I mean, that sounds...
Okay, so he probably is sarcastic.
Right,
okay.
But then we find out that someone has robbed a gang of crooks has robbed the box office.
This is the best part. This is where the story really kicks into high gear.
This is great. They robbed the box office because...
They took advantage of...
Everyone was distracted by the Human Torch shooting flames into the sky to distract everyone so that they could get through traffic.
The manager says some idiot set off some fireworks in the sky. And while everyone was looking at it, Three Hoods stole our payroll. We can't pay you.
The Human Torch is like in the background.
I love just him getting called an idiot in the panel because, yes, he's an idiot.
Exactly.
Big time.
So naturally, flame on time, clobber in time. They go and mess up more of everything, trying to stop three guys in a slow car.
This is where I have a big problem with the torch, as usual. These idiots have been breaking everything from the very first panel. Then they're like, oh no, someone stole the Beatles' money. Who cares? You know, they may not have been billionaires back then, whoever's left is, but it's probably okay. You know, do you have to destroy the highway? What they do is straight up criminal. They trash like a state highway.
Then an amusement park.
They destroy a roller coaster, which looks like expensive roller coaster.
A Ferris wheel, a roller coaster, and possibly the entire parking lot and
they smashed through even a wall that could have just been climbed over very easily hopped over. But he just smashes through it, and then he tears this huge roller coaster to pieces.
These are three normal guys with a gun. That's it.
They are not even like criminal masterminds. Just were opportunists. They stole some cash that wasn't being tended to. Yeah. I mean, these guys
they don't have paste. They don't have anything.
These guys are innocent. So they cause hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage, which at least, doubt the Beatles were getting paid that night.
They finally do catch the crooks for whatever that's worth.
And then they get back to the show just in time for the show to be done.
But Ben did bring his Beatles wig, which was sent to him by the Yancey Street gang in a previous issue. But Ben seems legit. So now I'm not sure if he was being sarcastic.
See, I don't know.
He seems very legitimately upset that he was not able to see this show.
He's also a moron. I mean, he might not even know what's going on around him.
Right. I mean, I do respect that he wanted to go bowling, though, initially. Yeah. He's like, well, I'd rather go bowling.
It's like everyone wanted to do this thing, so he's like, I want to do it too. You know, I don't think.
He's I just want to be a part of something.
Big, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and so that's how the half the Fantastic Four met the Beatles.
Thank God the Beatles got paid. Yeah, that's what I thought when I ended this comic.
Yeah, well, so that's the Beatles adventure for this month. Let's go ahead, we'll take another break, and then we have the debut of an exciting new supervillain coming up after our break, so don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Next comic we're going to talk about is Journey into Mystery number 114. It's a Thor story. The title of it is The Stronger I Am, The Sooner I Die.
The best Slayer song ever.
So good. It's written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby with Chick Stone. Before we get into the comic, though, gentlemen, on the cover, and we've seen this on a few of the issues this month, you see what's in the lower right corner?
The MMMS wants you.
Yeah, it's got a little picture of the thing. It says the MMMS wants you. Noah, do you know what the MMMS is?
I do not.
Rob?
The Mary Marvel Marching Society.
That's correct. This is the new fan club that Marvel had started up. It's pretty great. Like, one of the things you got as part of the membership kit was one of those, remember those flexi disc vinyls?
Yeah. Came with cereal boxes.
Yeah.
Like a really paper thin vinyl. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is like almost unplayable. Unless you were really careful with it. But it had like all the members of the Marvel bullpen singing on it and talking on it. The only one who refused to participate was Steve Ditko.
He never did an interview. He just was like, I don't
maybe
do that.
His voice sounded like mine.
I don't know. Your voice is beautiful.
Yeah, I know people like my voice, but because it sounds stupid.
Well, it sounds.
Or whatever. Like a cartoon character is what I've heard.
It has a dramatic range.
The people have been impersonating me at work going, hey guys, I'm Noah. Let's goof off on the clock in hopes that somebody will in the hallway will hear and be like, wow, Noah's really goofing off a lot
on the clock.
I have, yes. having worked with you, I have been guilty of exactly that.
Yeah, so bullied. Well, this comic book from 1965, it has the first appearance of the Absorbing Man.
Yeah.
His secret identity, not even secret, he just owns it, is Crusher Creel. Who is Crusher Creel? Well, he's a prisoner, and Loki sees him from Asgard, and he's spying on him mystically. He describes him as brutal, savage, consumed with hatred for society. So Loki basically gives him a magic roofie, and all of a sudden Creel has these incredible powers.
Yeah, anything that's spilled, he can just pick up with one piece of his finger.
Nope.
Oh, nope.
That's a different Absorbing Man.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, this one, whatever he touches, he can transform his body into. So if he touches metal, he can turn into metal. If he touches wood, he can turn into wood. And whoever he's near, he absorbs their power and copies it for himself. So you can see how this is going to be a problem for Thor.
Yeah. Speaking of Thor, where's he? As lame Dr. Blake, he's treating a reporter who tells him about the Absorbing Man. Oh, by the way, absorbing is a word I can't say correctly, so I don't know what it is. It's like one of my difficulties, but I say I have always said absorbing my whole life, and I have to
absorbing?
Say
absorbing.
Yeah, so I have to say absorbing in order to even get close to the proper pronunciation. So
now I don't even
absorbing.
Know how to.
Now I'm going to be super self-conscious about how I'm saying it.
Absorbing.
This is going to be impossible.
You really messed this comic up.
Sorry.
You know how often this guy is going to show up in Marvel comics?
I know. That's why I just realized how painful this is going to be for
good
all of us.
God.
Now.
All right.
I share my pain.
He keeps showing up as Absorbing Man?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, he's still
pretty
like,
much. He was in the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show.
His actual name is cooler than his
true.
I know.
Super name. He keeps explaining out loud.
Yeah, he does.
Over and over. Incessantly. That he has the ability to absorb this and that and rocks and metal and this tank. Like, he absorbed the armor of the tank. It's like, all right, you get it. But, I mean, he is a psychopath prisoner. Yeah. He's probably got a low IQ.
Yeah, so I tangented again, but lame Dr. Blake has to break a dinner date with Jane to investigate as Thor. So Thor follows his hammer, which somehow he's using to detect the absorbing man.
Yeah, it's like this is another one of those like occasional uses of the hammer as a dowsing rod, which shows up every now and then. It's like when Thor needs to find something and Stan doesn't feel like writing a good reason in.
Spidey sense, yeah.
It's everybody gets a Spidey sense.
He says, my enchanted Uru hammer begins to tingle. He only doesn't say it, actually thinks it, which is I appreciate.
Yes.
That signifies a supernatural menace is indeed near at hand.
So Thor follows his tingling hammer, and he
finally finds.
He gets near the absorbing man, who has disguised himself as a rock on a mountain, because he absorbed the... See, Noah... The way it works is when he touches something.
Yeah, yeah. I was at this point. I was like, "What's going on with this guy?"
I've forgotten. What is this absorbing man's?
So luckily,
power?
He then explains to Thor.
Right. It's like, here's how all my powers work.
Yeah.
So Thor starts spinning around like a little godly tornado. And so Absorbing Man is like, well, anything you can do, I can absorb and do too. So they're just spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning. And then the reporter who lame Dr. Blake was treating earlier stumbles upon them just spinning around in the woods like a couple of dudes.
Yeah. So, he actually is watching. He's like, oh, my God. But
he's lost all the hours of
the fight. Reporter is like, luckily, I brought some of these dynamite sticks with me in case I needed them.
Yeah.
What? Like a reporter? It's like remember Geraldo Rivera brought that gun to Iraq?
Yeah.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
This is basically a
there's no camera with
Geraldo
him,
Rivera
though.
Of 1965.
This is more of a Hunter S. Thompson kind of thing.
He's been huffing something.
He's carrying dynamite. That sounds like
bringing a pistol with you when you are like tracking down a dangerous criminal. That could make a little bit of sense. Bringing a stick of dynamite with you
to just see what's going on.
It's a crate of dynamite.
It's at least a
cigar box of dynamite.
Took it from a mining site. It's like that's like a wooden crate filled with dynamite. He's holding three sticks in his hand and there's lots more in the box. And so
you haven't overstated. Also, there's pages of this dervish thing.
I know. And also, do you know how heavy a box of dynamite is?
Yes.
Insane.
I mean, I know from carried road it. Flares,
there's no way his car's nearby. He's like in the middle of nowhere here in the, I don't know if they're in a
and
park.
And he just got his arm hurt.
That's probably how he hurt his arm.
Okay. He's carrying his dynamite. Yeah. He's going to a dinner date, going to an appointment at work, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so let's see.
Six panels later, they're still spinning around
still
like tornadoes.
The absorbing man spins the dynamite back at the reporter because he's still tornadoing. Thor protects the reporter, dynamite goes off, and as they're recovering, the absorbing man just runs off, steals some dude's car, and then like starts fantasizing about becoming the dictator of some small foreign country.
He's doing the thing I always love where it's like as soon as somebody who's going to become a criminal gets a superpower, they're like, I could rob every bank in the world, except for in this sense.
Yeah, this
case,
is
it
hype.
Actually makes sense because the dude is a garbage person.
Yeah, right,
he's like
a
prisoner. Like he's a felon by nature. So this is the first guy who got superpowers. It makes sense where he's like, you know, I could rob all these banks or I could steal an old lady's jewelry.
But he does think I could be the leader of a country or the world.
Or the world.
Yeah. Which is like puppet master style.
That's
like,
pretty ambitious.
And then you're like Doom where you're like, yeah, I do run a country. But he's a little smarter.
Yeah. So Thor catches up with him. They fight some more, and then suddenly this fog creeps up, and it's Balder,
of course,
from Asgard. He's created this mystic fog. He summons Thor to Asgard because Loki has kidnapped Jane Foster again.
So Absorbing Man believes that Thor fled, so now he thinks he's the only person to ever make Thor run from a fight.
Yep.
So he's pretty stoked.
He's pretty, it's not doing anything to deflate his ego.
The story ends with Thor preparing to attack Loki in his stronghold and the Absorbing Man holding up in a house in the middle of nowhere.
to be continued.
Yes. Yeah. So I was pretty bummed at the amount of to be continueds in this month, because I remember one of the things I really liked first time I was on the show,
they wrapped it up,
is that they're all self-contained, but this had multiple to be continued. I feel like that's a money grab. Yeah. You need to wrap this damn story up in this
comic.
You needed
3 pages. You can't show people spinning for 1 page.
I know, that fight sucked. two guys, they're not even touching each other. They're just spinning around like 20 feet away from each other for 6 panels. But I will say, you know, we were talking about comic book artists that draw horses and poorly, and this isn't the case. These are pretty good
Kirby
horses.
Kirby can draw
very
horse.
Good yeah. horses. Yeah,
but yeah, the just the idea of a comic book artist like, can you draw horses? It's like, yes.
Have you ever drawn a horse?
Yes. Is there money in it?
Okay. Let's go ahead and take our final break of the podcast, and then we'll talk about Fantastic Four when we come back here on Marvel by the Month. Okay, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Our last issue this month that we're going to talk about is Fantastic Four number 36. The issue is called The Frightful Four. It's written by Stan Lee. The art is by Jack Kirby, inked by Chick Stone. This is the Fantastic Four versus the very first appearance of the Frightful Four. So the Frightful Four is made up of the Wizard, who we've seen before, Sandman, and Pacepot Pete, who we've also seen before. making her debut is Madame Medusa. She shows up for the first time. The Wizard gets a new suit of armor. Sandman gets a purple striped shirt.
I love that his outfit is just a different striped shirt.
Yeah.
They're all like wearing like uniforms sort of, and he's wearing pants and like a shirt wears.
He's like the dress code purple. Like right. That's all they said.
They're very on brand.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the story starts out with Reed and Sue announcing their engagement to the world. It's all very exciting. We even have a heart-shaped caption box in here.
It finally happened. Reed and Sue have publicly announced their engagement, and the world's press goes wild.
Yeah, and the press is going wild.
Yeah, Kirby's shot is like Ben's trying to hold back people, and the cameraman's jumping on his shoulders to take a shot. Yeah.
This little scene ends with the Fantastic Four get a package that looks like a time bomb.
From the Yancey.
Yeah, and it blows up in Ben's hand, but it's just a dozen roses.
Somehow, inside of a time bomb.
And Ben is prepared to go, of course, lay waste to Yancey Street in the hopes of getting the gang, but he doesn't, because Reed and Sue are too smitten. They're like, let's just forgive everybody, man. So then we cut to the three members of the new Frightful Four meeting on a lonely wharf at the west side of town. Sandman sneaks up on Pacepot Pete and reveals a new maroon color scheme. So the Wizard descends before they start fighting each other. Luckily, we learn that Sandman and Pete busted out of jail at the same time that the Wizard was losing to the Human Torch in Strange Tales number 118. So that distraction helped them get out.
Yeah.
Wizard was floating helplessly into the sky when Pete and Sandman just happened to be flying by in a stolen jet. That was synchronicity.
Yeah, that was a suspending the disbelief on that one was a little challenging. Yeah,
because he had made this anti-grav device and that purposefully had been knocked out, and he was just floating into the air. He weighed too little to stay.
Right, he would have just gone up into the atmosphere.
And so he should have perished.
Yeah.
But they rescue the Wizard, who promises to repay them by giving them the chance to team up with him as part of an anti-Fantastic Four.
Which is sort of like when someone says that they'll let you design their band's logo for the exposure.
Right.
It's like, I'm not going to pay you back for rescuing me, but I'm going to let you be part of my team.
Cool, man. But of course, they want to really do this justice, so they need someone.
They have to have a female.
They have to have a female.
A perfect.
So who will be their Sue Storm?
Yeah. Well, it turns out she's someone the Wizard met on a small Mediterranean island. He was there
in between floating into space.
Yeah. Where, well, he's a worldly man. He's sophisticate. He was there on that island when the local police were closing in on her, and she fought them off with her living hair. Wizard, he gets himself a new suit of armor. He decided he wants to be called the Wingless Wizard, which absolutely no one is ever going to do.
Right. Not even in this
issue. No one called him the Winged Wizard before.
Yeah. It's, come on, man.
Why would you need, like, if anything, we're going to call you the Wiz. You know, we're going to give you a nickname, not add consonant or like syllables to this thing.
Yeah. So he shows up in his new suit of armor, and then he introduces Sandman and Paste Pot Pete to their new teammate, Madame Medusa. And she has super long red hair that she can control like Doc Ock's tentacles, and it's very strong. And
there's not really there's much, not really there's no explanation about how it works or anything. It's just it's like living hair. Yeah. I mean, what do you need to know? So everybody is preparing for this the engagement party, and the Frightful Four decide to awesome slip panel. Into the Baxter building during the party and attack the FF while their guard is down.
Yeah. So they take out the Thing first with Pete's super paste
right in the face and on the around his mouth. And his hands.
Paste in the face.
But always, he has an infrared sniper scope on his paste gun now. says there. That's how he was able to shoot the Thing in the dark.
Oh, that's right. Because Medusa turns the lights out with her hair. and then Paste Pot Pete it just gooshes him with the paste.
The more we describe the plan, the more it sounds harebrained.
Very plausible.
It's like he's using a glue gun or a paint gun to shoot glue out of whatever, but he has a sniper scope on it. Cool.
So then the wizard sprays sleep spray in the Thing's face to knock him out. And so the most powerful member of the Fantastic Four has been dealt with. So they make plans to take out the rest of the Fantastic Four, but before they can get started on that, Sue discovers them. She barely avoids being incapacitated as well. Reed follows closely behind her, and the two of them try to start fighting off the Frightful Four, but they're outmanned. They're fighting on their back foot from the start. Without Ben and Johnny, it doesn't take long for the Frightful Four to defeat them.
With more sleep gas.
More sleep gas.
Everybody's defeated by a tiny aerosol can of sleep gas.
Yeah, didn't prepare for it. And while that's all happening, Alicia Masters is hiding. She finds the FF flare gun and shoots it out the window to summon Johnny.
Yeah.
This is a blind woman firing a gun
out the window.
That is not a normal gun. It's something that looks like some kind of piece of tech, like the Fantastic Four tech. So,
because it makes a giant flaming four in the sky.
Somehow, that's not the most irresponsible thing that someone has done in this issue,
right?
Yeah,
or the most unbelievable thing. It's not at all. Meanwhile, the wizard attaches anti-gravity discs to Reed, Sue, and Alicia, making them party balloons, and they start floating helplessly toward the upper atmosphere.
Or they'll die.
Yep. And Johnny shows up and grabs the wizard, forcing him to fly his ship to the rescue. Johnny rescues his teammates in a rare moment of competence. And then the Frightful Four steal the FF's pogo plane and chase the wizard's ship. So now we've got a, air battle.
Yep.
Afoot. Sue forces the pogo plane, though, to crash with her powers.
So the pogo plane crashes with most of the Frightful Four, and the FF lands. The rest and the Frightful Four wait in ambush for them, but the Invisible Girl throws off Paste Pot Pete's aim. Oh no! And he goops up Medusa's hair.
No, that nice hair. Yeah, all that paste.
Then the wizard's ship explodes for a moment. It explodes, not for a moment.
They destroyed it so they wouldn't. The Fantastic Four couldn't get his.
Yeah, it seems like they might have been destroyed, but Reed doesn't buy it. They'll see the Frightful Four again.
Yes, and again and again and again.
Forever and ever. Amen. Yeah.
We'll actually see the Frightful Four again, I believe, at our live show at Books with Pictures on February 29th. Ooh,
placement.
Yeah, how about that? So that's this issue of the Fantastic Four, and that's all of our issues for the month. And that means the only thing left for us to do is talk about our panels of the month. Rob, I don't know if you've got one picked out and ready to go, but if you do, would you like to share it?
Yeah, I didn't write it down because I didn't finish reading things until right before I came here. But it's, I just love the revisit of Dormammu's wacky world in Strange Tales. This would be the page 5 of the Doctor Strange story. Panel one and two, they're like just these shots, but panel one is Dormammu on his throne with all these weird spacey ribbons, and you know, it's that Ditko.
It's cool. That's, yeah, I love that panel, and it's not Jack Kirby, which surprised me because it's so cool.
Yeah, this stuff, this like ribbony weirdness is Ditko's jam. Like this other dimensionally thing. So I've said it before, like that's, I just love it when he does it. I don't think there's enough of that highly designed stuff in this specific story, but just those two panels are just like eating like candy.
It's so good. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, mine comes from, I think I mentioned this earlier, comes from X-Men number 10, page 7, panel 3. So this is one of our first good looks at the Savage Land. Prehistoric Kirby it's not something you see all that often. Like later on when he gets into his 70s stuff, like Kamandi has sort of a sense of this when he does Devil Dinosaur. Yeah. It's just this really beautifully composed panel. It's a natural environment, with really nicely referenced prehistoric animals,
and flora and fauna, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just terrific. And I mean, it's like, it's about as accurate as you could be in 1965. You know, it's obvious he did a ton of visual research when he was drawing this. I mean, it looks very much like what we thought the prehistoric world looked like in 1965.
Yeah.
And it's great. So, I mean, this is one panel, but there's so many, like the very next panel has a bunch of miniature horses running around, which is so great.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
There's so many little weird animals throughout, like birds that look kind of furry, and I feel like that's all Kirby did.
Yeah.
This month. He's like, yeah, somebody else is doing Sergeant Fury. Somebody else is doing the Avengers.
Yeah.
I'm doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. But still, he did a ton of other stuff this month. Like he did Thor. He laid out the Avengers. He did the Fantastic Four. That's the thing that always blows my mind about Kirby is that you see, you know, a really beautifully drawn page or two or entire issue in a comic that just blows your mind, and then you realize like he drew 60 other pages that month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so he's doing like 2 pages a day,
just
wild,
cranking.
Yeah,
including the nippleless Captain America,
right? Yeah,
which I forgot to even get into.
Yeah, but you know,
there's not just Captain America, there are no nipples in that issue, and there are other men,
bare-chested nippleless men.
It's just when it's a weird thing of Earth 616 is that men don't have nipples. So
there you go, no prize.
Yep.
I have one panel that made me crack up.
Oh yeah, go for it.
That'll do.
Amazing Spider-Man number 22.
Mm-hmm.
Page 7, panel 7, but I'll lead into it with 6.
Okay,
this is right after he finally figures out how to get away from Betty so he can turn back in. So he drops her off exactly 10 seconds after dropping her off. He says, "At last, I'm free to go into action as Spider-Man, and I'm and the one I want to find is the Ringmaster."
Yes.
So he runs to the top of this building, and I guess his Spidey senses aren't enough because he says, "Ah, my electronic gizmo is starting to throb now. It'll lead me to the Ringmaster, and he's sure to lead me to the clown and his playful little pals." What? And I mean, even the next panel is, "It's throbbing louder now. I'm getting closer." Throbbing louder?
He doesn't sound like the guy who made that device.
That's what it felt like to me too. It's like, it's an electronic gizmo. Who made it? And why is it set to throb? It's like, oh, it'll lead me to the Ringmaster. It's like, all right, bud. What? I don't know what's happening.
Does your phone ring or vibrate?
It throbs.
It throbs, yeah. It throbs louder and louder.
Oh, okay. I guess that also makes sense. Nope.
All right.
Anyway, yeah.
Well, gentlemen, another successful episode, another great month of Marvel Comics. Noah, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having
me. The four-peat. The four-paste pot.
Yeah.
That's only two Pace Pot Pete's.
It's your frightful fourth appearance.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
How fitting.
So let's see. One more plug for the Books with Pictures show, February 29th, 10 days from when this episode comes out.
Ooh.
Books with Pictures live show.
On the special leap day, bonus day that you don't get in most years.
Yeah.
So just come.
It's just a waste of
3 days.
It's a bonus day. You can't possibly spend it badly. So spend it with us. Let's pack the rafters. Let's buy a ton of comics there.
RSVP through Facebook, I assume.
Yeah, Facebook. You can either go to the Books with Pictures Facebook page or the Marvel by the Month Facebook page. You'll find the event there. I think that's it. So my name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And we'll see you next week for next month.